All right, Team Pella, listen up.
Thanks, John Kuhn. Customers love our products with limited lifetime warranties. Check out these big plays. Incredible innovations like blinds and shades between the glass.
No interference on that play, Coach.
And stylish windows with hidden screens that make game days a breeze.
Can it get any better?
It can. With monthly payments as low as $19 per window, $75 per patio door, and a free quote at PellaWI.com.
Let's go.
6.99 APR for 120 months. Service restrictions apply. See show and details. Offers on 10/31/2023.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. Vince, we can sort of make light of this because nobody was seriously injured, but the freeways are just an absolute mess. A semi-truck jackknifed, and now you have diesel spills, and thankfully nobody was hurt. There wasn't like there was a string of collisions. I think one person had some minor facial injuries, but so that's the good news. The bad news is the freeway has been closed since your show.
It was happening. Yeah, Debbie was super busy in the 8 o'clock hour, I think, is when it started, where we, and then the full reveal later, like, oh, this is going to be a minute. Yeah. So between 8 and 9 o'clock, I think.
It is just always amazing to me that when we have these collisions and the closures and stuff, it always ends up being the worst case scenario. It's not just that the semi jackknifes. It's right. That the, okay, in this case, they've got a diesel spill that, okay, so diesel fuel is now, you know, spilled, and so you have to clean up the diesel spill. It just seems, and we went through a series where every time there was a truck that jackknifed or something, it was like pig guts on the highway or something like that. So you had to delay this for, so that the freeway is going to be closed for like 3 or 4 hours. It's not just like, oh, the box truck went over here. We can put it right and pull it off. So we'll continue to keep people posted on this, but between the rain and the construction and now the freeway closed, it's not a good commute.
It looks like they're getting close, Jeff. I mean, you have to think after 4 hours, right? But yeah, right. It's no easy thing to scoop up the diesel. I mean, get the kitty litter, I guess, or whatever it is that you do, or what the custodian used to bring around at the elementary school for spills and such.
It just is, and you feel bad for the people who are driving in, who have to get somewhere, or the people who, I don't know, live on the south side and work in Whitefish Bay or work, you know, in Sheboygan or whatever. It's no easy alternative.
I mean, depending on where you're at, the Hone Bridge is not always easy to get to. If you can get to the Hone, that's probably your best bet, or else 27th Street, as I indicated. 16th Street, I suppose, is another way across the valley and reconnect with the freeway there. But you're right, especially if you haven't been paying attention, or even think if you're just passing through.
Oh, right, exactly.
You're coming up from Kenosha, you're trying to get to Madison. You know, you can still make that westbound turn, but it's everything's backed up on you.
I remember the last time, a year ago, we drive down to our place in Florida, and you got to go through Atlanta. And Atlanta is just, it's a nightmare to get through. It's just, there's no way around it. It's a nightmare to get through. And so we were going southbound, and we were crawling, and I'm going, oh, this is really terrible. Until we saw that there was this collision, and they literally had the main freeway going northbound. Now, I was going the other way, closed. The traffic was backed up. I swear, Vince, it was 15 miles. I mean, I was just, and I'm going, okay, I shouldn't complain about having to crawl through this because, and this was, it was kind of like morning rush hour. I think we were hitting it, and I'm like, my gosh, I can't believe these people aren't going to get to work till noon.
And Metro Atlanta, what's that, like 8 lanes across maybe in some spots, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just a sea of concrete, right?
Right,
you
right.
Wonder
exactly.
And you're, how is there no way around this?
Well, right, and you're also trying to figure out, okay, I want to make sure which lane am I supposed to be in, because if I miss the turn off, then you know, who knows where it's going to be. But I've just, it's, you know, for people who, it really does make me appreciate Milwaukee traffic, and I complain about the construction on I-43 and stuff, but the bottom line is, if you had to do stuff like that every day, I'd be ready to just find a different place to work.
You'd even ride the streetcar to work if that's what it took.
Well, except it doesn't go anywhere. But yeah, that's
find a place close to the streetcar.
Well, exactly, and I'd have plenty of privacy. If I'm on the streetcar, you know, you can read the newspaper,
nice and
you
quiet.
Can do whatever. Okay, well, thanks for the update. We will keep everybody updated on the ongoing things. But right now, I-43. If you're coming from the south, moving northbound, you can't get through the Marquette interchange. It is closed. We will continue to keep you updated on that. Well, I don't know if the UAW and Ford was listening to the 2 o'clock hour of the program, but not necessarily a surprise, and this was what I was suggesting. Of course, for the last, what, 6 weeks or so, the UAW has been out on a partial strike against the big three automakers, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, which is now called Stellantis. And the demands that the union were making were they wanted 40% pay increase, and they wanted big cost of living bumps, and they wanted more money put in their 401k plans, and they wanted a four-day work week but five-day pay, et cetera. And so they were doing these targeted strikes against different companies. And the point I was making yesterday, which is the point I made during the course of this, is at some point in time, you've got to, in the words of the song The Gambler, you got to know when to hold them and you got to know when to fold them. And at some point in time, you have to realize, I think, in any sort of bargaining situation, where and when you've accomplished what you all can accomplish. As I often say, politics is the art of the possible. Okay, if you are a politician and you can get, in divided government, you can get 70% of what you want on an issue, take it, declare victory, move on. And sometimes when you decide, well, I'm just going to hang on, what you end up is you end up hurting yourself, you end up hurting your constituents, and sometimes you end up getting nothing. And what we were talking about yesterday was, given where the big three were, and Ford was offering, I think their last offer was like a 23% pay increase, and the union was saying, no, 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 no. And the point I was trying to make was, okay, at some point in time, and Ford was saying, no, 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 because the problem is if we start to give much more than this, we're just not going to be competitive. And that's just what the reality is. And, yes, what good is it if we make these concessions and we increase our labor costs and then 3 years from now we're having to have massive layoffs because we end up hemorrhaging money? So at some point in time, I always say that, you know, you should just kind of declare victory and move on. And yesterday, after my program, the union leaders announced that they had reached a tentative contract agreement with Ford, and the deal will include roughly 25% pay increases over 4 years. Okay, so they were looking for 23%. Their offer was 23%. The union had started at 40%. They settled at 25%, and now they're ready to move on and say, okay, this is what the deal is. And I think that's great for both sides, and it's certainly great for people who like to purchase American-made vehicles. And if you're a Ford owner and you are worried about getting your Ford serviced, well, I mean, assuming the union signs off on this, and the union membership would be crazy not to, all right, that this is put behind them. So, I mean, I give both sides credit. At some point in time, you've got to realize this is the best we're going to get, and maybe it's time to just declare victory, and that's apparently what the UAW has done. When we come back, and look, and I understand there's all sorts of stuff going on in the world. We will later on in the program talk about the mass shooting in Maine. We're going to talk about some of the latest developments in the Middle East. But I don't want to start the program off doing that. When we come back, the governor says, not our governor, but another governor says, give me a break. I will explain and we will discuss. So glad to have you with us. All right. What is coming up this weekend? Samantha, three guesses. Two don't count. It's Halloween. Halloween weekend. So for many people, it will be trick-or-treating. You know, in a lot of neighborhoods, they don't actually trick-or-treat on. I'm aware that Halloween is October 31st. But in many, many neighborhoods, they have the trick-or-treating on the weekend. So, you know, that will occur. Maybe in your neighborhood it's Friday. Maybe it's Saturday. There are other neighborhoods that are going to have trick-or-treating next Tuesday. It is kind of unfortunate that the weather has not cooperated. By that, I mean, you know, it's too bad that it's going to be cold because the cold front is moving through and the forecasts are by the weekend it's going to be, into the 50s during the day. And by next Tuesday night, I think I saw it might be in the 20s or 30s. So it's a lot of cold weather coming on. But it is in fact Halloween. So you got a lot of fun going on there. And people love Halloween. At the same time, Halloween has changed in character over the years because now everybody is so politically correct that if you show up dressed in, I don't know, a costume that would be cultural appropriation, and that picture gets put up on Facebook, then you're just going to get roasted for that, or maybe you're going to get fired, or things like that. So it's really, we've taken a lot of the fun out of Halloween, because nowadays, you know, everybody looks at the costumes people wear, and unless you, I don't know, maybe you can go as a baseball player, you know, maybe you can go as a fireman, maybe you can go as a police officer, but once you start, you know, once you start deviating from that, well, you run into trouble. Well, all right, Halloween used to be more fun. And I understand all that, and I'm not encouraging and I'm not endorsing, like, inappropriate sort of stuff, but I think sometimes we're losing our sense of humor. And this is a classic example of the story out of the New York Times today. Here's how it starts. If you happen to attend one of the 10 schools in New Jersey's South Orange and Maplewood School District, put away that Spider-Man costume on Halloween or wait until after school. Earlier this month, Dr. Ronald G. Taylor, the superintendent of the school district, sent a letter to parents saying that Halloween would not be celebrated during school hours. Okay, now it is not uncommon for schools to have, like, Halloween parties. You know, maybe you take the last hour of the school day and you have a giant costume contest or things like that, or you decorate, you know, the individual classrooms or things like that. So the superintendent sends a letter to parents saying that Halloween will not be celebrated during school hours. The decision was, the letter said, and let me just stop here before I go through it. It's not, this isn't, gee, we don't want to take an hour away from learning. The decision, this isn't based on, we don't want, gee, you know, the kids in this school district can't read and can't write, can't do math. So we don't want to waste a precious hour of potential instruction time for something frivolous like Halloween. That's not what he says. Here's what he says. The decision was, the letter said, an effort to promote, quote, diversity, equity, and inclusion meaningfully. No Halloween in an effort to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion meaningfully. I have no idea what that means. I just don't. I mean, that to me, it's Kamala Harris, you know, word salad. It's just, if we want to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion meaningfully. School districts like the one in South Orange and Maplewood have chosen to not hold Halloween celebrations in an effort to be more inclusive to students who either do not celebrate the holiday for religious reasons or whose families cannot afford elaborate costumes. Well, families can't afford elaborate costumes. You take an old bed sheet, you cut two holes in it, you go as Casper the Friendly Ghost. I mean, all right, you put some soot on your face, you go as a hobo. Can you say hobo in today's day and age? I don't know. The announcement from Dr. Taylor divided families in the district. Some fully supported the decision, pointing out that some of the elementary schools had already stopped celebrating the holiday. Other parents saw this as liberal good intentions going off the rails. And then the news found its way to the governor's desk. The governor, by the way, is a Democrat of New Jersey. On Tuesday afternoon, Philip D. Murphy stepped right into the fray, writing on X, formerly known as Twitter, "Seriously, we can't let kids celebrate Halloween. Give me a break." The post sparked a media firestorm and set local parents groups on Facebook buzzing, reigniting the same discussion that began weeks prior. All right. And then the New York Times goes on to kind of ridicule the governor for jumping into this. Our number, 855-616-1620. The school district cancels Halloween. No Halloween costumes, no Halloween parties, no Halloween-related events during the school day. The governor of New Jersey, of all people, says, no Halloween in the schools. Give me a break. 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. All right. Do we need to get our Halloween out of the schools? And by the way, if the argument was, all right, this is a waste of valuable economic time, all right, class time, academic time. Okay, well, maybe, you know, then you can have that debate. What are you going to do? But that's not what this is all about. This is about, well, we don't want somebody to feel excluded. 855-616-1620. What do you think? We discuss in just a moment. okay. No Monster Mash in New Jersey schools, at least during the school day, because the superintendent says, well, we're here to promote, I love the phrase, we're here to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion meaningfully. So no Halloween. The governor of New Jersey weighs in on this, and his response is, okay, so you can't celebrate, we can't let kids celebrate Halloween. Give me a break. One of our texters sent me a note that this is, let's see, I want to make sure I get the school district correct. Note that he was sharing with me, Monona Grove. And then, of course, that's going to be, that's Dane County, right? Of course. They're sending something saying, we respect cultural diversity among our families. And so as a result of that, we are not going to celebrate Halloween because that's our responsibility to provide opportunities for all students. Okay, well, I mean, one of our texters says, hey, you know, when I was growing up, we didn't celebrate Halloween. I just got to leave school an hour early, which would be exactly the response. Do we not have Christmas break anymore? I mean, seriously, do we not have, oh, I understand we call it winter break, but it comes because it is Christmas. At some point in time, first of all, even if you don't celebrate Halloween, what's the big deal? And this idea that, all right, so maybe you've got one kid in a class or one or two kids in the entire school that for whatever reasons they don't celebrate Halloween, there is alternate programming you can have. Or you know what? They could sit through it anyways. And my guess is, even if they don't come in costumes, they would enjoy if the school is passing out candy or things of the like. It would be a plus. Plus, don't you have to learn how you are going to get along in the world? Because here's the world. You know, there's going to be Halloween. So if you're somebody that doesn't celebrate Halloween, you know, you go into the store, you're going to see all the Halloween candy that's out there. You're going to see the display. You're going to see the Halloween programming. Don't you have to learn how to adapt and deal with things? And seriously, how is this any different than, I don't know, you know, whether it's the Jewish kids that are celebrating Rosh Hashanah, or whether it's the Christian kids that are celebrating Christmas. How is this any different than this? Don't you have to just learn how you deal with things? Heather in Milwaukee. Heather, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hey there. I'm surprised that you don't know this. Talking about New Jersey, they don't celebrate in Milwaukee public schools.
Does not surprise me. Because of the same thing, right? Just, diversity, yeah, equity, and inclusion.
Like, well, right, with like 60% of the kids under a poverty line and things like that. I mean, there's many reasons not to have costumes coming to school. It's just so much extra for the teachers to have to deal with. And quite honestly, like, we celebrate our holidays to the max outside of school with friends from school. They just don't do it in the classroom, and there's a lot of good reasons for that. And that goes for
give me the best
Valentine's
one,
now,
Heather. Heather, give me the best one for not taking a half hour at the end of the day in an MPS classroom and having a Halloween party. Give me the best one. Give me your best argument.
Just another thing for me as a parent to have to send to school. Maybe I have to get out of work to go to a Halloween parade. Maybe there's kids that can't get a costume together. I mean, I'm busy. It's fine with me if they don't dress up at school. We're going to do it on Saturday. We're going to do it on Sunday. We're going to do it on Halloween, too.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Heather. That's the big argument. I'm busy. I'm too busy to, I don't know, take a bed sheet and put it over and cut a couple holes in it. My guess is, by the way, that the same kids who, if the argument is, well, we can't make a costume for them to wear to school, my guess is those kids are going to find a costume to go out trick-or-treating in. I mean, that's just the argument. Look, we've gotten to this point where if the argument was, all right, we want to spend more time in the classroom and learning, that would be it. But that's not what this is all about. This is, maybe it's lazy parents. Maybe it's people, well, parents are too busy to do this. Maybe that's what it is. But it's this guise of, well, we don't want that one kid out of 100 who doesn't celebrate Halloween. We don't want them to feel left out. So my point is, okay, how does that kid go through the rest of life? I mean, is it the idea if, all right, in a workplace environment, if there's a Halloween party that's there, or they, what do we do here? We decorate different offices. That's what they do. So is this a violation of inclusivity and things like that? Now, if you do have some kid whose parents feel very, very strongly about him or her not participating. Well, I mean, I think that you should give them the opportunity to opt out of that, just like kids have the ability to opt out of field trips, just like kids have the ability to opt out of everything. But this, we've become like the no fun sort of thing, and we've become no fun for no, at least in my opinion, no good reason. We can't do that. I'm with the New York Jersey governor here. Kids can't celebrate Halloween, and I'm not talking about canceling all the school for a week-long thing, but, you know, you're talking about something at the end of the day. Where do we draw the line here? Let's talk to John in Franksville. John, you're on WTMJ.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for taking the call.
Yes, sir.
First of all, I can't agree with you more on so many points, but, I mean, the first one you just brought up was, it seems like this way that we're going is kind of bubble wrapping, especially kids, which we shouldn't be doing. But if I'm not Christian, I never want to see a cross, or I never want to see a Christmas tree. But it's just, it's such a shame, because like you already mentioned, America is such a beautiful country of all these different cultures and religions and beliefs. And why not celebrate them all? Why not celebrate Christmas and all the other seasons that are within that holiday? It to me is a beautiful thing. And actually the surprising part of it all is it seems to me that it's actually more of the liberal side of the spectrum.
Oh, yeah.
As far as viewpoints that are pushing this, where you would think it'd be the other way around. Why wouldn't they be open and welcome to all views?
Well, because there might be that one child or the two children who, okay, are they feel left out because, you know, we don't celebrate this. This is the same thing about how, you know, it's the same argument that's used to say you can't sing religious songs at we can't call it a Christmas pageant anymore. It has to be like a winter pageant. We can't sing Silent Night because there might be that child out there who, you know, isn't Christian, who might be offended or might not feel included in this. And to me, how are we going to deal with people? You know, if you're right, bubble wrapping is a great excuse for that. That's a great way to put it. Okay, we don't want somebody somewhere to be upset and offended about this, so we're not going to let anybody do it in the context of a classroom. I don't know about you, John. I remember Halloween parties in school, and you know what? I think we all survived.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's like what you said. It's such a, even for those kids that aren't exposed to that necessarily at home, the beauty of America is that they are exposed to it when they come together with other families and students. You know, I was exposed to these different religions and cultures. It was amazing, you know, and I think to push back against that, the best point you've made today is the bubble wrap. You're setting these kids up to,
yeah,
the real world's going to come, and they want it to be their world and not our world together.
Yeah, John, thanks for calling. You know, a number of texters are making this point, and I wish I would have said this up front. They're saying, how can you promote inclusivity if you're sheltering your kids from anything other than what they know? Which is such a great point. We want to be inclusive. All right, so the way you're going to be inclusive is excluding the vast majority of people from participating in an activity. That's somehow inclusive. No, I think you can make the argument that it's precisely the opposite. Diversity. What does diversity have to do with this at all? Diversity has nothing to do with this at all, because the truth of the matter is, you know, anybody can participate. Now, again, if you've got the parent because of their religious beliefs that is bothered by Halloween or Valentine's Day or whatever, but we're talking about Halloween now, and you want to let the kid opt out, I'm okay with that. I'll let the kid opt out, just like you can opt out, like I said, of field trips and things of the like. But to simply say, as a matter of policy, well, I'm going to quote the New Jersey governor, a Democrat, give me a break. Tom in New Berlin. Tom, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I agree with the school celebrating Halloween. And what I can do is I can talk from the aspect of a public school teacher without giving a name. I'm very, very good friends with a public school teacher in Waukesha County, and they're celebrating Halloween. And I just heard some of the comments. Actually, I'm an independent. I vote Republican as well as Democrat, depending. She's more to the left. And she is a kindergarten teacher, but nowadays it's full day, and they teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. And she bought a gift for like $1 each for Halloween for these kids, and they have a celebration. And one point I want to make of that. Now, one thing is so it's not a left versus a right issue, that's for sure. She voted for Hillary in 2016, and I did not. So anyway, one thing I want to make a point of is that now if there's one child that's against Halloween because of religious beliefs, then this is at a public school, then they cannot have Halloween in that classroom specifically, but other kids can. But anyway, one thing about celebrating Halloween is it's a fun thing for kids. It's not a religious thing. And it's important for kids to enjoy school and be happy, just like it is workers. The part of that is I know that one thing they do every hour, every 2 hours, is the kids get up and do jumping jacks and do some kind of physical exercise, because then they're more productive. So I think the celebration like that, it's just all fun. Nobody's thinking of Satan.
Yeah, now Tom, right? I mean, thanks for look. Here's one of our texters. This is crazy. When I was a kid in elementary school, all of the kids got dressed up and did a walk parade through the local neighborhood. The parents, the kids, the teachers, all of the neighbors loved it. You know what? All of the neighbors loved it. And I think that's the fair sort of response. And that's how most people would react to this. Here, we recognize this is a fun thing that you can do that actually, I would argue, rather than excluding people, it unifies the school. I mean, it brings everybody together. And as far as the thing, people can't afford costumes. Like I said, first of all, my guess is that everybody who would make that argument is figuring out something that they're wearing when they're going out and trick-or-treating. So, I mean, I reject that as a complete and total straw man. But this is just, it's an example of what is going on in the schools here where, again, we're so worried that there might be somebody somewhere who pretends to be upset. Because, honestly, I'm not really sure that unless you had somebody who was extremely hypersensitive, even if you, I don't know, didn't celebrate Halloween, okay, what's the problem with your kids sitting there and getting candy? I mean, seriously. If you feel so strongly about it that, oh, my gosh, my kid's going to be warped by the fact that he's, seen other kids celebrate a Halloween sort of thing. And, I don't know how you avoid that because, again, Halloween is something that people celebrate. But if that's your opinion, okay, fine, pull him out of school for that day. No problem at all. Chris in Cedarburg. Chris, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Give me a break, Chris. that's kind of where I am on this.
And if the kids are from the poorer side of town, okay, you put a sheet on and, you cut the eyeballs out and you're a ghost.
Right.
Okay? I mean, we've all been down that road and it's just, you're not going to be a kid for that long.
Right.
So you're going to exchange the costumes for a briefcase and a car and a time card. So let kids be kids. And if, like you said, if they don't want to be in the party, okay, then don't. Or if they don't want to dress up, fine, stay home from school and go to a movie with your parents. But right. You know what? What a joke. Let's not be so fragile.
Well, that's exactly. Thanks for calling. That's exactly. It's this fragile sort of thing that's out there. And look, I understand this isn't the biggest issue of the day. And I also understand that when it comes to fighting these cultural wars against public schools, we're losing because you have these pointy-headed intellectuals who have decided we can't do anything anywhere, anytime that somebody might not be offended by. So just because that person somewhere, and in many cases it's an imaginary person, might be offended, well, we can't do this because, it's the possibility of that. And until we get past this mindset, and until we get past this groupthink, it's stuff like this and traditions are going to die. And that is an unfortunate thing. But the fact that it's done in the name of diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's what's so really frustrating because, I mean, I think you can make a strong argument about, why you want diverse classrooms and why you want things to be fair across the board and why you want people to feel included. But you don't make people feel included by excluding people, especially people who represent the majority opinion that's out there. All right. The New Jersey governor, Democrat, says, give me a break. I'm with him. Truer words have not been spoken. Back with more in just a minute. This is Jeff Wagner. I'm getting swamped with text, but here's one. Jeff, I just left a nursing home that had kids in costumes walking through. The kids and the residents had a blast. Right. For all those people out there who say, well, we should not have, you know, allow the kids to have a Halloween party or that. How about this? You know, what if it's a field trip? Hey, we're going to go. It's Halloween coming up. The kids are going to dress up in costumes. We're going to bus them to a nursing home and, you know, we're going to give out candy and stuff like that. Should we not do things like that? All right, is that where we are coming? Because, well, somebody might not feel, I might be left out because we don't celebrate Halloween. So should we not be able to do things like that? That is a classic example. And how does that work? When we were a number of years ago, you know, every year we get involved with the Capco Kids to Kids Christmas thing. And for a number of years, We used to do a live remote from a nursing home facility on the southwest side. And routinely what would happen is, so they decorate it, they'd set it up like a winter wonderland and things like that. And school buses with kids would come, and they would bring toys, and they would donate the toys, which were then given to less fortunate kids. Should we not do that? Can schools not participate in that because somebody somewhere might be offended and upset? I do not think so. Jeff, this is another example of helicopter parents and the left. I'm sorry to say, what if there is a kid or two? What about the vast majority of kids? What damage is being done when good, clean fun is something to be outlawed in public schools because there might be an issue for a very small minority? Once again, it's the tail wagging the dog. It's just the tail wagging the dog. Exactly. I agree with it completely. Jeff, the more things we eliminate, the less diverse we will become. Or am I thinking wrong? That's exactly right. If our goal is to promote diversity, I thought the idea of diversity is to understand different cultures and to appreciate and to tolerate different points of view. Isn't it the fact that we fail, for example, if you look at the problems in the Middle East, isn't that part of it, that we fail to appreciate other cultures and things like that? So how do you become more diverse? How do you promote diversity and tolerance, understanding, if you say, well, we can't have a Halloween celebration because there might be some child somewhere, you know, who does not support Halloween or does not celebrate Halloween? Well, doesn't the kid have to learn that there is this thing called Halloween? Just saying. All right, when we come back, cry me a river. Stick around. Oh, by the way, for those of you who are keeping score at home, the stock market in the tank yet again today. The NASDAQ, the tech-heavy NASDAQ that took a brutal beating yesterday when the parent company for Google announced earnings, and they missed their earnings number, and the NASDAQ dropped about 2%. It's down another, let me give you the raw numbers. It's down another 200-plus points today, which is like 1.7%, because, again, these tech companies are just, they're underperforming. Today, it's Meta, which is the Facebook company, and they're dragging the overall market down as well. The Dow's down let me give you the raw numbers here. Dow down about 200 points as well. Just a rough time. The NASDAQ is now into a correction, which means it's 10% off. It's high. And nobody quite understands where the end is going to be, which frustrating for a lot of people. And I don't think things are going to get better till interest rates start to go down and things like that. But another really, 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 did I say really bad day in the stock market? Okay, cry me a river. All right, there's a story in the Journal Sentinel today, which, again, this is one of those things that makes my head want to explode. There are people in the Wisconsin prison system who were sentenced prior to January 1st of 2000 who did really, really bad things and got really, really long sentences. And they are eligible for parole. We don't have parole anymore, But so these are people that have been in prison for a long time, and they're eligible for parole. You will remember the controversy a year or two ago when Tony Evers, who is committed to trying to reduce the capacity at the Wisconsin prison system by 50%, and the only way you can do that is either not send people to jail or let people out of jail earlier. So Tony Evers is parole head of parole board ended up getting canned because of his decision to release people who, by any objective measure, should not have been released. So the new head of the parole board is a former state senator named John Erpenbach. And Erpenbach, when he took over after this scandal, his mission was, okay, first of all, we've seen how badly this blew up when we just started to willy-nilly release people who are on parole. And secondly, so we want to be careful about that. And secondly, if we are going to release people on parole, we want to make certain that all the victims and the surviving family members of these people that we are getting ready to release on parole, we want to make sure that they're notified, because there's nothing worse than finding out a year and a half later that the guy that murdered and raped your sister has now been turned loose on parole and has been wandering around free. You talk about victimizing the victims. So there's this kind of weepy story in the local newspaper today talking about how, all right, after over 24 years of incarceration, Travis Coleman was informed by a parole commissioner in May that he was recommended for parole and he might be released by June 20th. Coleman, now 57, has been in and out of the criminal justice system since his youth, and he's been sentenced. He's been in jail since March of 1999 for a string of robberies with a threat of force. Okay, so they say, all right, you're coming up for parole. That's fine. Well, it turns out he wasn't actually released by June 20th. He's still in jail. And the reason he's still in prison is because they haven't been able to properly figure out and find and notify all the guy's victims. And so the story is, oh, isn't this just terrible that, you know, he's being held, you know, even after somebody has recommended him for parole. And the head of the parole commission, John Erpenbach, is saying, look, one of my charges, we're not letting nobody has an absolute right to parole. I mean, it is a discretionary thing. And one of the things Erpenbach is saying is we're not going to let people out until we have made sure that their victims, surviving victims, family members of victims, till we've identified all these people and they have been notified, and presumably we give them a chance to perhaps object to this. So this guy's been in prison for an extra 5 months, and the story is, oh, isn't this terrible that he's still there? Cry me a river. It's not terrible at all. If you didn't want to be in prison in the first place, well, you shouldn't have committed the crimes that got you there. Parole, again, there's no right to parole. I mean, and so before we are releasing, or before we should be releasing, dangerous people or people who did dangerous things, you want to make sure all your T's are crossed and all your I's are dotted. And you want to make sure that all the victims' families have been notified. And if that means some person who's committed crimes of violence or whatever has to stay in prison for an extra 6 months or 8 months or 9 months, what's my response? Four words, cry me a river. Back with lots more right after the top of the hour news.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. Greg, I was listening to your report. So which Packers, who's out now again?
So Eric Stokes was a first-round draft pick a couple years ago.
Right.
He hadn't played much at all this year. He played just a handful of snaps last weekend.
He was out for a good portion of last year, right?
And now he's been put back on injured reserve, so minimal 4 weeks that he's going to be gone. They're also dealing with Devondre Campbell, who's not on injured reserve, but a starting linebacker who is not able to play. They just can't absorb the kind of injuries that they're being forced to absorb right now.
Well, and then, you know, I was thinking about this, and then you had, who was it? Was it Savage, the safety, who
of a calf injury.
Right, pulls a hamstring, essentially, or something like that, right?
It was a calf, and that had been a nagging injury for him throughout the season. But he came back, and if you watch the game against Denver, there was no contact. He just sort of went down.
He took a step right in the
field.
Then, Is this, I'm always wondering about this, because I understand football is a violent game and you have these people that get involved and need these huge hits and you can see where those injuries come from. Seems to me the Packers have more than their share of what I would call like soft tissue injuries or things like that. Oh, there goes, I mean, Aaron Jones, it's the hamstring. You know, it's not contact. He pulls a hamstring or injures a hamstring and he's been on limited stuff. Is that the kind of thing that you wonder about, you know, what's going on with the strength and conditioning stuff? I understand somebody smashes you in your knee, you know, you have this knee injury, you tear cartilage, but, you know, you're just running and boom, there goes the hamstring. Isn't that the type of stuff that you should maybe be warmed up for?
So let me ask you this. Just think back into your time. If you didn't play basketball or tennis or even golf for a period of months, and then he went out there and just tried to play, you were probably pretty sore the next day.
Sure.
But if you played every day or every other day, your soreness would probably dissipate. And it'd just become normal. This is what my body expects. I don't think the Packers truly play football throughout the course of training camp.
Yeah.
Their practices are like an hour and a half long. I think they had one practice that went over the 2.5 hour mark last year. There's no hitting. There's no tackling. Nobody's bumping into each other. Starters play very minimal throughout the preseason. And then all of a sudden you're expected to play, you know, 80 to 100% of the snaps with real live collisions happening. They do not replicate this in the month of July and August.
And the from like my perspective, the hamstring, the stopping and the starting and all these type of things to really simulate that game day sort of thing.
I feel like the body is not conditioned for NFL football throughout the course of training camp in the preseason. It's soft. It is so soft.
Right. And I guess I understand that there's injuries that come in football, but it's just, or in the case of like a David Bakhtiari, okay, the guy has a catastrophic knee injury and then, you know, he's not able to recover from it in many surgeries. But that's a catastrophic knee injury. That's not, hey, I twisted my ankle or I pulled my hamstring, which I guess I don't understand how professional athletes, and this is your job, and you're paid millions of dollars, how you go out on the field and not be appropriately warmed up. And it seems to me that's just that's in some respect it's a strength and a conditioning coach that says, okay, this is what you got to do to get yourself warmed up.
Well, it doesn't appear as if their body's ready for the load of the NFL season when the NFL season starts. And that might be more on the coaching staff and the strength and conditioning staff. Perhaps it's all intertwined, but they are not being pushed in August. At all. I just don't think they're ready to start tackling and colliding the way they do with what they do or don't do in August with the preseason and training camp.
And when you have a team like the Packers who are not, by any stretch of the imagination, the most talented team, you can't keep losing, you know, these players because, you know, the backups just aren't. I mean, if you look, I mean, there were some people playing last week, and I swear I'd never heard of them before, and that's because maybe I don't study who's number 45, on the 53-man roster.
Yeah, or as my dad said, we have a Sims. Who's Sims? Yeah. Well, he's a tight end, apparently, and now he's playing.
Right.
Right, so it is one of the youngest collection of pass catchers in the history of the NFL. And that's not a joke. That is the truth. It's also complicating the evaluation of Jordan Love.
Right, sure.
When receivers are in the same spot, going the wrong way, just not in the spot where the quarterback expects them to be, it's challenging to try and evaluate the quarterback when his receiving threats are so inexperienced.
Right. At the same time, when you're throwing into double and triple coverage.
Well, that doesn't help.
Right. Or there's a guy who's wide open 10 yards in front of you, and you throw an interception to somebody who's double covered 40 yards down the way.
Yeah, there's stockpiling issues here right now is what they're doing.
Right, got it. Okay, I was just sort of wondering because it seems they have more than their share of injuries that are like really non-contact related. So, all right, you helped clear that up.
Well, I hope I did.
You did. All right, so we were going to continue to keep you updated on what's going on the freeways. If you are trying to come north on I-43, go through the Marquette Interchange, you can't. You can't. There was a semi that jackknifed about 7:30 this morning. There is an ongoing diesel fuel spill, and they've been trying to clean it up, and we don't have an idea as to when they're going to open it up. I bring this up because one of the things that has been discussed over the last several weeks, months, is you have a bunch of these anti-freeway, anti-car people who have come up with this harebrained idea that what we should do is we should tear down I-794. I-794 is the freeway spur, which hooks up I-43 goes east, it gives different outlets to people who are immediately east and west of the Milwaukee River, and then it hooks up with the Hone Bridge, so you can go down the Lake Parkway, the Lake Freeway there. The idea is, let's tear, and these are people who really don't like cars. That's what this is all about. But the idea is, hey, if we tear down this freeway, we're going to spur all sorts of economic development under the area. Okay, well, you're also going to make it impossible for people to get across the Milwaukee River, because, I mean, think of all the times those bridges come up, whatever. So if you make all this traffic, people who would go from, for example, by Marquette, and instead of being able to easily hook on the freeway and go to the east, or if you're coming from the south, vice versa, you take that away. Can you imagine all the extra traffic that's going to be on city streets? Can you imagine, you know, how you're going to be able to get across the river when during the summer you've got the bridges that are up constantly? It would be a complete and total disaster. But I bring this up because can you imagine if we didn't have I-794 today? 43 northbound closed before the Marquette interchange. So what are we telling people? Well, okay, there's alternate routes. If you've got to get into downtown and you live to the south and you take the freeway, go over and come across the Hone Bridge. And then what you can do is you can hook up onto, you know, the I-794, and that'll take you. You can still get there. So can you imagine what would have happened today if we didn't have I-794 and you didn't have that as an alternative route? So, you know, people would essentially be stuck. Everybody would have been dumped onto 27th Street or whatever that might be. Can you imagine what the commute, can you imagine what the traffic would look like? It's just another reason why tearing down I-794. Look, there's some things that reasonable people disagree on, and I appreciate that and respect it. And then there are other ideas which are just dumb. Tearing down I-794 is just dumb. When we come back, all right, let's talk about this horrible situation going on in Maine. Stick around. All right, another day, another mass shooting. This one in Lewiston, Maine. Lewiston, Maine is the second largest city in Maine, which isn't saying much. Lewiston, Maine, I think, has like 40-some thousand people. The largest city in Maine is Portland, Maine. That only has 66,000 people that are in it. The number, I was looking up this number, the entire number of homicides in the entire state of Maine in 2022 was 29 homicides. I mean, that's a summer month in Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee. But in the entire state of Maine, 29 homicides in all of 2022. Well, everybody probably knows the story by now. You have this guy, they're identifying him. His name is Robert Card. He lives in Bowdoin, Maine. I said this earlier. I almost went to college in Bowdoin, Maine. There's Bowdoin College, which Bowdoin is a small town, about 3,000 people. And it turned out I was very serious about going there and ended up not. But it's beautiful. Maine is not a heavily populated state. The hunting culture is big. And the guy lives in Bowdoin, Maine. But it's the shootings occurred not that far down the road in Lewiston, Maine. And what happened is he goes into a bar and he goes into a bowling alley about 4 miles apart and he starts shooting them up. And you've got, I think the numbers are right now, 18 people dead. 12 people are injured in this mass shooting. And the guy is on the run. And it's on many levels, it's a scary situation. He's former military guy. He's a firearms instructor. He knows the area, and there's lots and lots of trees and lots of places to hide out. Some of the reports suggest that he might have access to a police scanner, so he might be able to monitor, you know, where the cops are. It's a horrible sort of situation that's out there. And again, whenever we have these shootings, a lot of the conversations center on, again, a lot of people will talk about, well, why do we have access to guns and things like that? Maine doesn't require a permit. Maine, again, is a big hunting area and things like that. So, you know, I don't know that banning the guns is practical. The dazzling detail in this case that jumped out to me is the fact that authorities, he was on people's radar. has not been convicted of a felony, but he was on people's radar. This summer, he was institutionalized. He was committed to a mental health facility for 2 weeks. Now, they haven't provided all the details of the guy's treatment, but the reports are that he indicated he was hearing voices and threats to shoot up the military base where he worked as a firearms instructor. So he was committed for 2 weeks. And again, you knew that there were all sorts of red flags about the issues that this guy had. So you're committed for 2 weeks, and then apparently he was released. And apparently there was little or no follow-up, and nothing was done to try to identify whether he had firearms, et cetera, et cetera. So once again, we have this situation where you have somebody who was, number one, clearly dangerously mentally ill, and number two, mentally ill in a way that was known to the authorities, and yet nothing was done. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. Now, look, I've been on the air for a long time. So, I mean, I can remember the conversations when Columbine happened. And we've had these conversations before. And I understand that there's some people who want to make this about the gun. My issue with that is, as a practical matter, we've got all these guns that are out there in society. And unless you're going to start trying to confiscate guns and things like that, you're not going to get them guns off the street. But in many, not all, but in many of these shooting instances, what you find is, when you identify who the shooter was, it is apparent that there is a huge mental illness problem. And I think it raises these questions of, when you have somebody who, for example, says they're hearing voices and the voices are telling them to go kill a bunch of people and shoot up a military base, why isn't there some follow-up done to identify whether this person who's hearing these voices has the access and the ability to do this? And you got a military guy who clearly has access to all sorts of weapons who's saying, oh, the voices in my head are telling me to go kill a whole bunch of people. How can you just let him loose and say, okay, well, here, go with God, go back out there? And again, I understand some people want to make this about the guns. That, to me, is a different conversation. To me, this is clearly an issue of mental illness and a failure to follow up on someone who, well, I mean, again, sometimes it's completely unpredictable. I can see that. You'll have these shootings and everybody will say, well, we saw no indication. There was nothing. There was no indication that this person was going to act out in this fashion. And I understand that is true in some cases. In this situation, and my guess is, the more details that emerge, the more scary it's going to be, because, again, he was committed for two weeks this summer. 855-616-1620. Don't we need to do more to identify those dangerously mentally ill people among us who have access to weapons, and then be aggressive in trying to do everything we possibly can to deny them access to those weapons? 855-616-1620. Will it stop all the mass shootings? No, of course not. But it seems to me it's a place to start. 855-616-1620. We discuss. One of our texters says, well, you have to be careful about taking the guy's guns away without due process. Please understand, I'm not saying you deprive people of due process. But when you have somebody who, for example, is committed to a mental facility for a couple weeks because they're hearing voices and they're telling you that he's, you know, that he wants to, like, go kill people on a military base, to me, that's an indicator that something's going on here. And, you know, maybe it's an indicator that what we need to do is take away the guy's guns. Yeah, I think. And I guess I hope that would be something that almost everybody could agree about. Everybody should be able to agree about it, that if you have somebody who has demonstrated that they are dangerously mentally ill or have the potential to do that, that they shouldn't have access to firearms. Does that solve all the mass shootings? No. I concede that it doesn't. But how many times have we seen these mass shootings, and then it goes back and it turns out that, yeah, I mean, everybody knew that there were all sorts of big-time red flags, and being committed to a mental facility for 2 weeks this summer. I mean, recently. This isn't even like it was 5 years ago. This is recent. It was just this summer because you were hearing voices that were telling you to go kill people. Huh, maybe that's something that you should follow up on and act on. Mike in Crystal Lake. Mike, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Good afternoon, Jeff.
What do you think?
Hey, I just wanted to say, I really don't think we need much more in the way of gun control. We need to tweak a couple of controls, but we need to enforce the laws that are there right now. This is a perfect case of how the guy was definitely needed to be restrained from weapons. The psychiatrist should have contacted law enforcement. They should have acted on it before he got a chance to do what he did.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of needing more laws. It's more enforcing the laws you have.
Right, and doing the follow up. Yeah, I mean, thanks for calling. I guess that's my point. I don't know. I I'm not sitting here advocating necessarily that, although, you know, I think you have to take a look at some of the red flag laws that are out there. And I understand that that's a very, very controversial thing. And, you know, how do you determine if somebody is dangerously mentally ill? Now, one of our texters makes an interesting point. Jeff, I'm in no way condoning what the shooter did. But, you know, the 2 weeks in the psych ward was probably to get him back on his meds. They discharged him because he was probably doing well. If there was no follow-up, it was probably because the patient didn't show up for his scheduled appointments. Severe mental illness is very hard to treat. Patient has to cooperate. The guy probably did not. Now, I don't know, but let's assume for the sake of argument that that is an accurate statement. I guess, to me, if the only thing between somebody shooting up a bowling alley or a military base or a restaurant is a voluntary decision for somebody who is dangerously mentally ill to stay on his meds, well then I don't want to depend on that. That to me would be a situation where we should red flag the guy and he shouldn't be around firearms. I think it's just very, very clear. If you need to stay on your meds in order to not kill a whole bunch of people, and unless we have any way of monitoring on a daily basis that you are, in fact, on your meds, that the easy thing would be to say, okay, we're going to create this classification where we're not going to let people have access to guns. Is that going to be perfect? No, it isn't. But as a starting point, if you accept my basic premise that given all the guns that there are in America, unless we're going to start banning weapons, and again, you reach this whole point. I mean, Maine's a huge hunting state. It's not like an urban area where you have hundreds and hundreds of homicides. They had 29 homicides in the entire state. So it's not like there's this huge problem with violent crime. And I don't know that that's the justification for saying to everybody, we're going to make you surrender your hunting rifles or your handguns or whatever that might be. Maybe the more practical step is to concentrate on that very, very small percentage of people who are, in fact, in this case, dangerously mentally ill, and concentrate on our resources on, number one, trying to get them the help they need, and number two, trying to get guns out of their hands so they are not in a position to do this. And I understand, believe me, that hindsight is always 20/20, and that's the frustrating thing, because you can always go back and you can say, well, you know, He was threatening, he was hearing voices, and he was threatening to kill all these people, and we put him back out on the street. And I understand maybe there's a lot of people that are like that out there, but it seems to me this is where the priority has to be as we try to evaluate this and say, okay, what can we do? If we accept the basic premise that we're not going to eliminate guns from our society, and you're not going to take in Maine, you're not going to take hunting rifles away from people and things like that. If you accept that as the reality, all right, then what's the next best thing that we can do? And maybe concentrating on those people who are dangerously mentally ill and known to be dangerously mentally ill around here. You know, that's it. Somebody says, Jeff, are you assuming that he possessed the gun legally? Yeah, I am assuming that he possessed the gun legally. The guy was a certified firearms instructor. Yes, I think so. You know, that's just kind of the reality that's, you know, out there with this. Now, some people are pointing out that, we have, all right, well, you know, you have mentally ill people in places like Japan and you don't have the mass shootings. All right, here's the thing. Countries are different. The United States and our culture since this country was founded has been private gun ownership. Now, if your argument is going to be that what we need to do is we need to let's abolish the Second Amendment, let's no right to own firearms, and let's confiscate guns. Let's go to Maine, confiscate all the hunting rifles. Let's confiscate all the handguns. Now, first of all, explain to me as a practical matter how you are going to do that. It's not like Great Britain. It's not like Australia. It's not like Japan, where you don't have private gun ownership that is kind of part of the society. The reality, and when people want to talk about this, I always want to say, let's deal with the reality. The reality is you're never going to ban guns in this country. You're just not. And I think you can make a strong argument that you shouldn't ban guns in this country. Just because like some crazy guy kills a bunch of people in Maine, which is a terrible sort of thing. I mean, is that a justification for taking everybody in Maine's firearms away? And my argument would be no. It's not practical to do that. It's not realistic to do that. The argument this is concentrating on identifying the people who should not have access to guns. That's why if you are a regular listener of this program over the years, you know that I am death on felons in possession of firearms. It frustrates the you-know-what out of me that, you know, when somebody who is out, a felon, gets caught, you know, has a gun in addition to committing some other crime, one of the first things that they end up doing in the district attorney's office around here is they drop the felon in possession charge. Drives me absolutely crazy. You know, if you're a felon, you shouldn't have guns, period. And if you get caught with a gun, there should be major consequences, including you're going back to prison. You're not going to pass go. You're not going to collect $200. And whether you use the gun or not, felons shouldn't have guns, period. Same thing is true for people who've demonstrated, you know, dangerous mental illness. You shouldn't have guns. Let's start by concentrating the resources on figuring out how to get weapons out of the hands of people who should not have them, who aren't legally allowed to have them, or by any imagination, any common sense sort of thing, shouldn't have them, like a guy who was in a mental facility a couple months ago, because he was threatening to kill all sorts of people. Gee, and he acts out a little bit later. I think, obviously more details are going to emerge about this, and hopefully they will catch him and stop this threat before anybody else gets hurt. It is a terrible, terrible thing. Nobody has all the answers to it, but maybe we can recognize that, you know, when you have people who are dangerously mentally ill, maybe we can all agree that they shouldn't have access to weapons, period. Back with more in just a minute. This is Jeff Wagner. Samantha, producing the show today, and always, we have cameras here. We talk about that all the time. We have you can watch us on YouTube. You go to the YouTube channel, go to WTMJ, and hundreds and hundreds of people, sometimes thousands of people watch this, or you can go to WTMJ.com and click the stream live thing. Today, Samantha is producing the show. Actually, we should have the cameras turned on you in the studio, because as we've been saying for the last couple of days, I spent the vast majority of my career at Radio City, where we shared space with WTMJ TV, and it was a building that was built, 1920s, 1930s, and had a flat roof, and it leaked, and the carpet was just awful. And the heating system, you either had heat or you didn't. There was no in between. And you never know when you were going to get it. Honest to God, it could have been the middle of July, it's 90 degrees, and the heat would just be blasting out of the radiators. Or it could be, January, and it's 10 degrees outside, and the wind chill is 20 below, and there's nothing coming out. There was just no in between. Now, I would rather be hot than cold, so I leveled that. But you know, so we've moved into our new studios and stuff, and supposed to be taken care of. So over the last couple of days, in our studio here, Well, yesterday it got up to 79. Today in the studio it got down. It's now down to 74. So it's a little bit cooler. But the room where our producers are, I've been for the last hour and 43 minutes, I've been looking over at my lovely and charming producer, Samantha, who is sweating, who is doing the fanning herself thing that kind of, I don't know, for you ladies in the audience who've gone through like menopause, that's what I think it is. It's kind of like, okay, I'm getting these hot flashes. She's getting these hot flashes. I am feeling your pain, or at least I'm feeling your heat, because it's kind of like, wow, you know. And but, you know, we're in the new facility. You would have gotten along fine, you know, in the old facility as well. And it's just, we're still, I keep being told that somebody's working on it. Don't know. Okay. Yesterday, we were talking about this. There's this new coffee place. It's called Octane Coffee. It's in Pewaukee. And it's what it looks like. It's a little kind of like a Quonset hut. And what happens is it's a drive-through thing. You can't go inside it. There's nothing in there. And it's not staffed. What happens is this is automated drive-through coffee. So what you do is you can go, download the app, you get a QR code, you say what the coffee is that you want, and then it tracks you on the GPS system. So what happens is the robots know when you're like 30 seconds away or a minute away, and then they make your coffee. And you just go through the drive-through thing and you pick it up. There's no people there at all. And some people like it, and some people, it's never going to put coffee shops out of business, because if you want to go in, you want to sit at a table and you want to have a donut and you want to talk to your friends or whatever, I mean, there's still going to be that. But this is, hey, I'm heading to work, I'm heading somewhere, I just want to get a cup of coffee quick. This is what that market is. Now, whether it succeeds or not, I guess kind of time will tell. But the larger point I was making is, this is one of the classic examples of be careful what you wish for. In California, they have just passed a new law that will up the salary for fast food workers to $25 an hour. You got to make $25 an hour. And everybody's applauding. Oh, that's great. You got these people, they're making fast food stuff, and they're going to make $25 an hour. Well, the be careful what you wish for unintended consequence of this is more and more places are going to get rid of people, and they're going to go to robotics, because, you know, they're pretty soon, I think, you know, if a fast food place, if it has 10 employees at any given time, I wouldn't be surprised if it's down to 3, because you're going to see more of the self-service kiosks, you're going to see more of this ordering stuff, because once you make the initial investment into the technology, what ends up happening is, okay, all right, I've spent the money, but, you know, in 6 months, I've got that all paid back. That's been the payoff period, because I'm working with, in my example, 3 employees instead of 10. I've saved all this money, and now moving forward, everything's gravy. And so that's what's going to end up happening. It's the unintended consequence. Hey, you're getting more money, but oh, by the way, there's only 3 of us working now, not 10 like we used to. There's another example of unintended consequences here as well. Right now, the actors in Hollywood are on strike, right? And they've been on strike for going on 100 days. They went out on strike after the writers went out on strike. The writers have settled. Okay, they've settled their thing. And part of the writers' claims were that they were not getting a fair share of residuals from the shows that they worked on that went on to like the streaming services, like Netflix. You know, the argument was, well, you know, when we're entitled to money when, you know, our shows are rerun on regular TV. You know, TBS is carrying Friends. Well, people that wrote Friends, they get residual checks every time they air Friends. But it's always been different when you talk about the streaming services. So one of the big issues was the writers were saying, we want more money. When shows air on Netflix, Hulu, Peacock, whatever it might be, these old shows, we want the money. We want a bigger share of residuals. So here's the deal. So they settled the writer's strike, and the Writers Guild told its members that Netflix residual payouts for certain shows will increase from the current $18,684 for a one-hour episode to $32,830. So the idea is, hey, you know, if you were the writer on this show, you're going to get a huge chunk of more money. You know, your residuals are going to be higher. All right, everybody applauds. That's great. You know what Netflix has started doing? They're dropping the shows. They're saying, okay, especially for the underperforming shows that are out there. There's some shows that get streamed all the time. There's other shows that don't get streamed and anywhere near as much. So what's happening is these streaming platforms, and it's not just Netflix, but I'm using that as an example, they're sitting there saying, okay, we've got 50 or 60 shows that are on our streaming platform, or 90 or 100 or whatever the number is, and we've got 40 or 45 that are really popular, and then we've got another 45 that are kind of obscure, and sometimes people watch them, but they're really not driving people to subscribe to Netflix. They might be something that, all right, you know, you're looking for something to watch, and you're looking for a series, and you say, maybe I'll try that out, but it's not something that's moving the needle. So what Netflix is starting to do is, all right, rather than pay the increased residuals for the shows that not that many people are watching, they're just dropping the shows. So on the one hand, yes, the writers, they're going to get 32 grand instead of 18 grand. But a lot of those writers who worked on a lot of the shows, they're going to get nothing because the streaming services are dropping those less popular shows. Again, for the people that wrote the shows, worked on the shows that you know, everybody wants, hey, I like Cheers or I like MASH or whatever that might be. Yeah, they're going to get greater compensation, and that's great. But for this large number of other people, they're finding out, be careful what you wish for, because I would argue $32,000 is better than $18,000. $18,000 is better than nothing. And a lot of these people are going to end up with nothing. It's just an unintended consequence. Back with more in just a minute. This is Jeff Wagner. Coming up after the top of the hour news, is this enough so that all is forgiven? Will all be forgiven? I'll tell you that story and we'll discuss. I have a very good friend who sells Harley motorcycles. My buddy sells Harley motorcycles and has been doing it for a long time, and he's very, very good at it. And it's one of the things I always kind of check in, because even though it's kind of a year-round job, the reality is, and I'm not saying you never sell a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. I'm not saying you never sell a motorcycle in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in November or December or January or February, but the truth is, most of the sales are done in the spring and the summer and the early fall. Why? Because you can't ride a bike around here from probably, well, November through, you know, the spring. So, and again, I understand that you can go out and you can say, I'm going to buy this bike in November, and then I'm going to have it, I'm going to be ready to ride it come, you know, April or whatever. But that's not how a lot of people operate. It's more like, okay, it's spring, the riding season's going to start, I'm going to do it. So summer, if you're looking at motorcycle sales, summer is the big time. It just is. And Harley-Davidson just reported their numbers for their summer sales, and they're not good. They said, okay, so they announced today that their overall revenue was for the quarter ending September 30th. So this would have been July, August, September, was 6% lower than the same period of last year. Their net income was down, well, about $63 million. And while analysts were predicting this, the problem is it's significant because this is kind of a report card. Now, I understand there's lots of issues that are there. The chief executive at Harley says, well, there's a challenging macro and consumer backdrop. Macro, I assume, meaning like the overall economy, and I certainly get that. But they've reported a 16% decrease in motorcycle sales in their latest quarter. And that's if fishermen go where the fish are. And, you know, there's the old adage, the cliche, you want to make hay while the sun shines and all that sort of stuff. And if you're selling motorcycles, you want to sell them during the summer. And when the numbers decrease that much, it's kind of a bad sign for people that are out there. I don't know what the ultimate solution is. And I'm not saying that people aren't buying Harleys, But this is a situation where, you know, if, you know, Harley's got to figure out, you know, who the next generation of Harley riders are. Because I think for a lot of people, they still, Harleys are viewed as, oh, that's my dad's view of recreation, or that's my grandfather's view of recreation. Until you can figure out a way to really reach into the newer, younger population, this is going to happen, and you're going to see it being a declining brand. But in any event, the summer numbers are in, not great for Harley, which is too bad for this community. When we come back, is all forgiven? I'll explain. We'll discuss.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back. Samantha, producing the show. I was trying to figure out why our viewership really spiked. I think it was after I mentioned the fact that, you know, I was going to encourage you to put the camera on yourself to show how hot it is back there. You say, no way, that is not happening. It's... All right. I'm just saying our viewership just spiked, you know, after I mentioned that. I think people, you know, less Jeff, more Sam. I think that's no. Okay. All right. Well, all right. Then you're just going to be stuck with me for the next hour. Couple people have started texting in saying, Jeff, you know, we know you're planning on retiring in about a month and a half or so, but, you know, we'd be cool if you pulled like a Brett Favre or you pulled a Tom Brady and just made a comeback. And in which I very much appreciate that sentiment, and you might be cool with that. But trust me, there's this really cute blonde at home who would not be cute with that, would not be happy with that at all. So, you know, you got me till December 15th, and we'll try to go out on a really, really high note. No question about it. I was listening to Wyatt's newscast, and of course we had the reports, and we talked about this yesterday. Craig Counsell, and if you weren't listening yesterday, a couple months ago, I said on the air and also privately to friends, I don't think there's any way he's coming back to Milwaukee. And my guess is next year he's going to be managing in New York. Why? And everybody, oh no, he would never go to New York. He's got, you know, kid. He's a Wisconsin guy. He's got the house in Whitefish Bay. His kids are in college, etc. He might not come back and manage the Brewers, but you know, he'll take a few years off. And my argument, and I was poo-pooed. Ha ha. People laughed at me. Say, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, look, here's why you go to New York. First of all, New York Mets, the president of baseball operations is David Stearns, who, you know, you've worked with in Milwaukee for years and years. Secondly, the owner of the New York Mets has more money than God and is willing to spend it. They just blew a whole bunch of money last year on a really, really bad team. So if you're Craig Counsell, you go to New York, you're working with the guy that you worked with for years in Milwaukee. He will undoubtedly make you the highest paid manager in Major League Baseball. And money is no object when it comes to paying for players. So if you know, a year and a half ago, the Brewers dumped Josh Hader in a salary dump because they knew he was eligible for arbitration last year and he was going to get $15 million. And then they knew that he was going to be a free agent. And they had no chance of re-signing him. So the idea is, okay, let's cut our losses. Let's see what we can get for him. You know, Corbin Burns in the same sort of situation. The Brewers have one more year of control of him and he's going to be a free agent. And I don't think anybody thinks he's going to re-sign with the Brewers. Somebody else is going to come along and pay more money. That's just the reality. So you can go to a team like New York, and I understand you got to live in New York and there's all that pressure, but what's going to happen is you've got an owner who will say to you, okay, Craig, all right, you know, David Stearns, here's what you get to do. You figure out what players you want, and then I'll get them. You know, you want to keep Josh Hader? Sure, we'll open up the checkbook and do it. You want to keep Corbin Burns? Okay, we'll open up the checkbook and we'll do it. And it's no guarantee that you're going to get everybody, but you're not going to have to make this decision saying, well, we can't even compete for all these players because, you know, we're a small market team and we've got these budgets. And I mean, I think the Brewers have done a great job of being competitive, but let's understand there's always going to be this issue. And just because you have the highest paid players doesn't guarantee you the World Series. Look at the Mets this year. Look at the Yankees. Look at some of the other teams. But at least it makes it easier when you're not constantly having to get rid of talented players that have come through your organization and go with younger people because you can't afford to pay them. So that would have an appeal. And I mean, I just put myself in counsel's position. If I was a manager and somebody offered me to make me the highest paid manager in the game. And look, let's face it, everybody's goal, is to win the championship. So if you're a manager, you want to win the World Series. Where does Craig Counsell have a greater chance of winning a World Series? In Milwaukee or in New York? Maybe not next year, but a year or two down the line. So who wouldn't go for that? Now, I'm not saying he's necessarily going to be gone, but for all these people who were poo-pooing me and saying, oh, there's no way he'd go, you're nuts. That's just the reality. It makes eminent sense. And I don't fault him for doing that at all. And so the fact that, you know, now it's apparently he's going to interview, I wouldn't be surprised. What did a little bit surprise me is the report that in addition to the New York Mets trying to interview him, Cleveland wants to interview him. Well, okay, this is with all due respect to my dear friend Stephanie Graham, who does traffic and stuff and has over the years here, who is from Cleveland and loves Cleveland. With all due respect, here's the choice. If you could go to New York and have an unlimited budget, you know, and be the highest paid manager in the game, or you could go to Cleveland. Huh, let me see. New York or Cleveland? New York or Cleveland? I think, you know, it's fine if you want to interview for the experience, and there's lots of nice restaurants, you know, and check out the Gaslight District in Cleveland. Great place to go to have a beer or something. I'm sure it'd be an entertaining trip, but if he's going anywhere, my guess is he's going to be going to New York. When we come back, all right, we'll all be forgiven. It's an interesting conversation. Stick around. Okay, there are bad marketing decisions. There are really bad marketing decisions, and then there is Bud Light. Now, we have talked about this before. When I drink light beer, I'm a Miller Light guy. And then I'd probably number two be Coors Light, and then number three would be Bud Light. But there's really not that, in my opinion, there's not that much difference between the three. But for the longest time, Bud Light was, of course, the top-selling U.S. beer in America. And then Bud Light came up with the marketing strategy that what they wanted to do is they wanted to be, what was it we were talking about earlier in the show, more inclusive. So they decided to launch a March Madness promotion featuring Dylan Mulvaney, who is the transgender influencer. And the promotion included Mulvaney posting a video on Instagram showing a Bud Light can with her likeness and sipping a beer. Well, there was an enormous backlash about this, and we talked about it, and you can argue whether it was justified or not, but it happened. And as a result, Anheuser-Busch InBev revenue in North America fell by 10.5%. Volume fell 14% during the second quarter. The company's stock was down 16% from $66.57 on April 3rd, 2 days after the Instagram post. It was a complete and total debacle for Bud Light, a debacle which has continued because it's easy for people to boycott Bud Light because there are other choices. It's not like, well, for example, when somebody wants to boycott the NFL, the problem is that there's not really other football. I mean, I understand there's college football, but there's not like other pro football that they can watch at the same time. Whereas, you know, when you're talking about light beer, all right, I'm mad at Bud Light. So, and again, I'm not talking about the wisdom of this or whether it's fair or whatever. It's just what the reality was. So, but it was easy to do that because people could say, okay, I'm mad at Bud Light. I'm going to boycott it. Here, give me a Miller Light or give me a Coors Light or whatever. It was easy to do this because you could still drink your beer and you could make your statement. And lots of people did it. And Bud Light has been reeling ever since. Now, my two golf buddies, Mike and Dick, they are dyed-in-the-wool Bud Light drinkers. And so after we play golf on Sunday afternoon, when we go to the tavern, they'll order Bud Light. But if you talk, some of the people in the tavern kind of mock them. There's no question about it. I've told the story before. Occasionally I will go to Total Wine, and I haven't done this the last time I was there, but the first couple occasions when this Bud Light controversy was raging, I'd ask the people behind the counter at Total Wine, you know, and they've got a huge beer section, and I'd say, you know, are you selling much Bud Light? And I will tell you, the reaction I got was, we're selling almost none. Used to be our top-selling brand. Now people just aren't buying it. So, you know, people were voting with their wallets. They were voting with their feet. And did that mean that nobody was drinking Bud Light? No. But a lot of people, you know, were making the decision that they were going to boycott this. And Bud Light has been trying to figure out, how can it get back on track? How can it stop itself from the mistake it made? So here is the latest story. Bud Light has just become, for the second time in like 15 years, Bud Light has become the official beer of Ultimate Fighting Championships. Bud Light, this is the story in USA Today. Bud Light and the UFC, Ultimate Fighting Championship, are reuniting as the beer maker continues to pour dollars into marketing after its partnership with a trans influencer sparked a sharp sales decline earlier this year. The two companies announced on Tuesday that Bud Light is becoming the official sponsor of UFC in a new multi-year marketing partnership that goes into effect January 1st. Bud Light will become the official beer partner of the UFC. In addition, according to the news release, Anheuser-Busch will receive a deep level of integration into key UFC assets, ranging from live events, including broadcast features and in-arena promotion, to original content distributed through UFC's popular digital and social channels. Bud Light will also receive prominent branding at every UFC event and will be integrated into custom broadcast features in all U.S. pay-per-views per the release. Anheuser-Busch and Bud Light were UFC's original beer sponsors more than 15 years ago. I'm proud to announce that we are back in business together. That's what the Ultimate Fighting Championship CFO says. There are many reasons why I chose to go with Anheuser-Busch and Bud Light, most importantly because I feel we are very aligned when it comes to our core values and what the UFC brand stands for. I'm looking forward to all the incredible things we will do in the years ahead. Now, I cannot imagine a more diametrically opposed, you know, marketing strategy from, on the one hand, going from the transgender activist and influencer in March to now we're going to be the sponsor for UFC moving forward. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's night and it's day. But Bud Light is doing this because obviously they're still reeling from the backlash and they're trying to get a lot of people that drank Bud Light, they're trying to get them back. 855-616-1620, that is the old National Bank talk and text line. Is this going to work? You know, will partnering with UFC turn around the fortunes of this brand that rightly or wrongly, fairly or unfairly, that's not what the issue is. It happened. It is the reality. Will striking a partnership with UFC, they've also been more aggressive with the NFL as well, starting to go back to some of these more traditional advertising outlets for, you know, beer, particularly understanding, you know, who the real Bud Light drinkers are. Is this going to turn it around? 855-616-1620. We discuss. Okay, I spoke too soon. When Wyatt was doing the top of the hour news at 2 o'clock, we were talking off the air, and he said, "Boy, stock market's down again." I said, "Well, actually, be careful because it was down big time, and now it's kind of clawed its way back." So, yes, at the 2 o'clock hour, it was down, but it wasn't down anywhere near as much as it was. Well, kind of taking another turn for the worst. Dow Jones down 0.64, the Nasdaq down 1.75%. The Nasdaq is in a, which is the tech. It's tech companies. Yesterday, it got killed when Google missed earnings. And today, there's some other. I think Facebook is having a bit of a problem as well. So, you know, it just kind of is what it is. The Nasdaq is now in what they call a correction, which means you're down 10% from the high. And it's kind of brutal if you've got money in the stock market with interest rates going up and stocks going down and don't know exactly what the end of this is. So today's not as bad as yesterday, but it's not good. That's just kind of the reality. Okay, when we did our the last listener cruise a year ago August, and it was an Alaskan cruise, and I had never been to Alaska before, and we flew into we flew into Anchorage, and I'd never been to Anchorage. I'd never been to Alaska before. So, you know, we stayed overnight before we took a bus to wherever we caught the cruise ship. But we were in Anchorage, and I got to walk around Anchorage. Anchorage, Alaska. If I were to describe this, Anchorage, Alaska reminded me of Appleton, Wisconsin in 1975. If you think back to Appleton, Wisconsin in 1975, there weren't high-rise buildings there. It was kind of small. The buildings were older. I just thought, man, this is Appleton. You know, this is Appleton when I was a kid. That's sort of what it was. Anchorage did have and does have a huge problem. And the problem is there are a ton of homeless people in Anchorage. And it was actually, you know, when we got there, some of the people were saying, I want to walk around the city. I like to walk around the city and stuff. And some of the people were saying, okay, but, you know, be careful because there's lots of panhandlers. Some of the panhandlers can be aggressive. There's lots of people that are out on the streets that have problems with drug and alcohol and mental illness and stuff. So I wouldn't just be, you know, wandering down side streets on your own. And of course, you could have done that in Appleton, Wisconsin in 1975, but they were saying not to do that. And as we walked around, I was struck by the number of street people that there were. So here's the story in the Wall Street Journal. The number of Anchorage residents without homes, they estimate grew nearly 60% between 2019 and 2023. They estimate that it's about 1,700 to 1,800 people. That's more than big cities like Indianapolis, Louisville, Baltimore, and Oklahoma City based on point-in-time counts that are conducted every year. And of course, you know, Alaska's got, you know, the winter. We got winter here, but you know, Alaska's winter, which is coming on quick, is just brutal. So, you know, here's the deal. Mid-November is when it typically gets really, really brutally cold out there. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to, okay, what can we do to try to get people off the streets? Because, you know, when it's 10 degrees below zero in December, you can't have people living on the streets. And they're finding that they're not having, they have a little bit of success, but it's not as much as they want. So here's the plan. Part of the plan to deal with this is to take homeless people and to offer them one-way tickets to the lower 48 states. The mayor of Anchorage says, look, my focus is keeping people from freezing to death. And he said, you know, let's see, last year we had 43 people who died from the cold. And that's up from like 3 or 4 years ago. We're home to 40% of Alaska's population. We're dealing with this issue. And so one of the things that we are willing to do is we're willing to buy people plane tickets and send them down to the lower 48 states. In essence, just kind of move the problem and, hey, you're homeless, but here's the ticket. We'll fly you to Seattle, or we'll fly you to Portland, or we'll fly you wherever. Our number is 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. All right, so their solution in part, and I don't mean to be too harsh, because they try to find, you know, temporary residences for people as well, but they don't have enough of that. So their answer is, we'll buy you a plane ticket and we'll send you to somewhere, presumably on the West Coast. Right? Is that responsible? 855-616-1620. How do you feel about that plan? We discuss in just a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Jeff Wagner is back right after this on WTMJ.
So I came to Advent because I was experiencing recurrent sinus infections. As a new mom, it was really kind of difficult.
Many of our patients complain of sinus infections. The headaches, fatigue, and nasal stuffiness have a profound effect on their lives.
I just felt like your sickness starts affecting your energy level and, you know, the things that you really enjoy doing. That really was a breaking point for me.
So Molly came to Advent. Abnormally tight sinuses and swollen turbinates led to simple breathing triangle solutions that ended up taking about 20 minutes in office. And very soon thereafter, she was breathing freely.
I'm just in awe at the amount of air that that I'm able to breathe in and out each night. And I haven't had a sinus infection since the procedure.
I'm Dr. Madan Kandula. When you breathe well, you do live better.
Results may vary. Artwork, especially original artwork, can be pricey. But when you take it in on consignment from nice people like you who are just ready to change the look of their home, you can price it right. And you'll find a lot of it at Design Exchange. Beautiful frame pieces by a number of notable artists. And new ones pop in all the time. This is Katie with Design Exchange, where discerning buyers with discriminating tastes come to find premium home decor at a value. In Heartland and Pewaukee.
Design Exchange.
Now these tend to fly off the shelves. But don't worry, because our connection supplies us with a lot of them. Vintage ceiling tiles from once great old buildings in New York City that make for ultra-unique artwork. These items are definitely hard to find from anywhere else around here. So come take a look, and you'll probably find a treasure. This is Katie with Design Exchange, where discerning buyers with discriminating tastes come to find premium home decor at a value. In Heartland and Pewaukee.
Design Exchange.
Staples stores provide innovative products and services for small business, remote workers and learners, even teachers and parents. Explore more at your local Staples store.
We keep you safe, warm, and dry. Semper Fi.
SemperFiRoofing.com.
Hi, this is John Neal, CPA, best-selling author, and founder of The Neal Group, with over 40 years of experience helping businesses make money and keep it. 2023 is almost over. How are you doing? Do you even know how you are doing? Do you have money in the bank? Are you getting the advice you need to minimize your taxes and put more money in your pocket? Do your calls get returned and questions answered? We help you look at your numbers and understand what they mean. How would you like an extra $10,000 or $100,000 in your pocket? We can help you now, before the end of the year. Using tried and true strategies, we have helped countless businesses increase their profits and lower stress. Our Neal deal guarantees you'll increase your profit or you don't pay us. Really. If you want to get started on the road to making more money and having less stress, visit nealgroup.net right now. That's NEALgroup.net. The first meeting is free to see if we can help. Again, nealgroup.net.
This is Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
So Anchorage, Alaska, which is a big city in Alaska. And again, I was there a year ago, August. It reminded me of Appleton in 1975. Huge problem with homelessness. And this is Alaska. So you leave homeless people out on the streets in November, December, January, February, you're going to have lots of people dying. And that's what they've had. Their initial response was they took this old hockey arena where a professional hockey team used to play, and they converted it to hold up to 500 people. Well, that didn't work because they had problems with drug use and assaults and other crime, and so they ended up having to close that. So they're wrestling with trying to find places for the homeless people to be. But one of the things they've started doing is buying them one-way tickets to other cities in America. And they're talking about expanding that. Hey, okay, you want to get out of Alaska? Here, we'll buy you a ticket to go to, well, some of the places, Phoenix, Dallas, Los Angeles. But my guess is, as this program kicks off, that you're also going to see lots of people, Seattle, Portland, places that are closer. All right, what do you think about this as an idea? Now, one of our texters says, well, is this any different than, you know, Texas shipping, you know, people who've come into this country illegally to New York City or Chicago? My answer to that is yes and no. It's yes, you're taking your problem and you're moving it somewhere else or moving them somewhere else. At the same time, the difference would be these are people who are from Alaska, as opposed to you could argue that this is a crisis. The border crisis has been created by the federal government, and it's expecting El Paso or somebody else to deal with this. So they're just trying to share the burden. But, I mean, it is similar. I don't think it's necessarily identical. Dave in Green Bay. Dave, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
I got a son that works for the city of Anchorage, lives in it, has been in Anchorage for about 10 years now. And the problem is people come up there to do seasonal work. And it's so, but they don't check into how expensive it is to live in Alaska.
Right.
So they make enough money during the seasonal times to exist. But then they find themselves with not enough money to get the heck out of there.
Okay.
Or to live there. And it's crazy, expensive to live in Alaska. It is expensive.
Sure.
I've been there several times, and I agree with you. It's Appleton, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not a bad deal, and my son was saying they have had people take them up on that, and they're willing to go, but they you think rent and to live is high around here now. It is crazy in Alaska right now.
Oh yeah, no, thanks for call, Dave. So I mean, and I guess that's from the perspective of, I guess here's where I come down on this. Unlike, and I'm glad one of the texters brought this up, unlike moving people from the border, that's caused by an external problem. You know, the border is out of control. People are pouring in. They're overwhelming some communities. And the idea is, okay, if this is caused by this federal failure, what we expect is that if you want to be a sanctuary city, that's fine. You should share the burden. In this particular case, Alaska is saying, this is our problem. But we want to dump these people into, you know, other situations. I wonder how fair it is to Portland or Seattle or whatever to have Alaska say, okay, we've got these people here. We're just going to fly them in and then it's going to be your problem. Now, if there's housing that's arranged and you've made a deal with Seattle or you made a deal with Portland or you made a deal with Dallas or whatever that you can handle the people, that's a completely different story. If they have relatives that are there to take them, and if it's like Dave was talking about, okay, if you've come up to Alaska to work on whatever and, you know, now you can't afford to get back and all, well, and you've got, you know, a brother and sister who are willing to put you up in Phoenix, well, sure, to me, that makes sense, and that is a moral alternative to saying, okay, we're going to try to make you go into a shelter. And it actually could be a cost-effective way. On the other hand, if it's just, here's a plane ticket, you know, go with God, and we're sending you down to Fort Worth, I have issues with that for public policy. Okay, let's take a quick break. Back with more in just a minute. This is Jeff Wagner. I have now officially reached the point. Stop fooling around and get this done. The story in the local Madison paper is how Wisconsin Republicans in the Senate are floating changes to win approval for funding the Milwaukee Brewers stadium repairs. Here's the reality. Let's kind of cut through this. There is going to be a deal to keep the Brewers in Milwaukee. I understand some of you don't like that, but this is just what the reality is. And what we're talking about now is nothing but a bunch of political posturing. That's all that this is. You've got Democrats who, by and large, at least, I mean, they're doing saber rattling, but they should be getting behind this too, especially a lot of Milwaukee Democrats, because the truth is, having the Brewers at American Family Field for the next 25 years, it benefits southeastern Wisconsin in general, and it benefits Milwaukee in particular. So you need to get off your high horse, and you need to vote for this. So the legislature, the assembly, comes up with what I think is a workable proposal. It passes with a degree of bipartisan support. It goes over to the Senate. Now it's getting jerked around there because some people are thinking, well, okay, maybe what we want to do is we want to impose a revenue tax on tickets to concerts and stuff to help supplement it. Oh, okay, but just get it done. I mean, that's not going to change this materially, but I think people are just worn out by this entire thing. Here's the reality. It's going to happen. So let's make it happen sooner rather than later and stop all the drama.